Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm Lance Thurner, host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Professor Pablo Gomez, associate professor in the Department of History and the Department of Medical History and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we'll be talking about his new book, Experiential Caribbean, Creating Knowledge and Healing in the Early Modern Atlantic, out last year from the University of North Carolina Press. And Experiential Caribbean examines the strategies by which health and spiritual practitioners in the Caribbean claim knowledge about the natural world during the 17th century. With penetrating research and analysis, Gomez illustrates how these specialists of African descent devised localized ways of knowing health, nature, and the body while working within cosmopolitan Caribbean societies in which ritual traditions from around the world intersected. And in a region that was of majority African descent, these practitioners rose to become the intellectual leaders, devising epistemological innovations that spoke to, engaged with, and were parallel with European scientific developments, but have hitherto never been included in intellectual history. So, Pablo, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Lance.
Yes. So, can we start a little bit about how you came to this project? And I understand that your initial postgraduate degree was an MD, and I'm wondering a little bit how you get from that to the Experiential Caribbean.
Yeah, that is a good question. So yes, I before becoming a historian, I was a physician, an orthopedic surgeon, and I came here to the States initially to do research and a clinical fellowship on orthopedic surgery. But after spending a couple of years working and thinking about these issues of corporeality and the philosophy of science, I had an opportunity to work with several people at the University of Iowa. I decided to undertake grad studies in history, and specifically in the history of medicine and science, with a focus, obviously, on Latin American history and the Caribbean more specifically. I came initially to grad school with the idea of working on 20th century histories of orthopedic surgery and more generally of the industry around implants. But after I took a course with who ended up being my mentor, Professor Jane Landers, it became obvious to me that there was a whole field that had been kind of left outside of what we consider traditional histories of science and medicine, and that is the type of knowledge production about the natural world, about the body, that most of the people living in the Caribbean actually developed. And that is the reason why I switched focus very early in my grad career. I believe it was during my first or second semester, and started working with these spaces. The other reason that I ended up working specifically on the 17th century Caribbean was that it is a world that usually left outside of the histories of the Atlantic and the region, in the sense that when we think about the Caribbean, we usually think about plantation, spaces, plantation-based economies, and the systems that they develop, and obviously, and for good reasons, right? Like the Caribbean, and specifically places like Jamaica, Barbados, Cuba, San Domingue, they figure prominently in the histories of the Atlantic as spaces for the imagination of models of capitalism, as places for the development of racialized plantation systems, and the emergence of first ideas of race, for instance, and also in terms of histories of science, as spaces for exploration and experimentation later in the 18th, 19th, and 20th century. But the 17th century, I believe, occupies a crucial space in not only the histories of the region, but more largely in the histories of what we tend to think as histories of science, right? Obviously, the vaunted scientific revolution, with all the caveats that historians of the Iberian world have developed over the past decades. And yet, these spaces that were populated mostly people of African descent, as you said before, but also that did not conform to those ideas about slavery as basically shaping the whole cultural and social systems. There was a space where, by the end of the 17th century, most people were free, inhabited by people of African descent, and many of them were not necessarily just Bozales or Africans just arrived from the old world, or even first or second generation. They have been established there for several decades already. So it was a space that was rich, that counted with very, very important records that also had not been explored in this way in the historiography. So it became obvious to me that this was a very important history to tell, and one that provided plenty of opportunities for interventions in traditional histories, not only of science and medicine, but more largely of the Caribbean itself, and in the conceptualization of what it means to be a Black, what it means to be a person of African descent, what is the position that these historical actors occupied in the histories of the Atlantic.
That's great. And so this is a history of the Caribbean, as opposed to saying that your narrative is a history of, say, coastal Colombia or Venezuela or Panama. What's the significance of it being a Caribbean-wide project?
I believe that it is crucial to understand this not as a history that is bounded by the usual regimes of the nation state or the biased royalties, right? But this is the other thing about the project that was exciting for me. Most histories of colonial Latin America, and again for good reason, focus on the biased royalties of New Spain or Peru, and later in the New Granada. The Caribbean does not conform well to these narratives, to these imperial bounded histories, because it was a region that it was only either British or, well, in this case, English or French or Spanish in the imagination of Europeans, right? These spaces were very fluid in terms of the mobility of the populations that inhabit them, the cultural spaces that were developed there. So in that sense, it was also very fruitful for the exploration of different kinds of cultural, but also material and experiential products, right? So the Caribbean, in the case of the book, encompasses a space that goes from South Florida all the way to, as you say, Cumaná, the province of Cumaná in what today is Venezuela, going through Cuba, Jamaica, Puerto Rico, Panama, Veracruz, and it centers in the northern part of the New Kingdom of Granada, what today is Colombia, also a region that usually has been left outside of those histories of the Caribbean, which is odd if we consider that Cartagena was probably, especially during the first decades of the 17th century, during the last decades of the 16th and first decade of the 17th century, the main city in the region, the central space for the arrival of African slaves and the bringing of gold and silver from the New Granada and partially from Peru too. And it was a space also that Cartagena specifically, where you will have a congregation of cosmopolitan congregation of people coming from all over Europe, Africa, and the Americas. So it doesn't conform very well with that, with those histories that we know so well about colonial Latin America, partially also because the indigenous populations that become the basis of the viceroyalties of in Spain and Peru were not present. They did not disappear as many histories of the Caribbean will have it. It's true that 80 to 90% of the population disappear, but they certainly were decimated, and there were also populations that were on the move. I'm talking about the indigenous population, the Amerindians in the northern part of the New Kingdom of Granada and in other places like Puerto Rico or Hispaniola.
And so the people that your book is about, at one point you mentioned that you're going to call them, for the purpose of the book, Mohanes or Moanes. Can you describe who these people are and why you chose that term for them?
Yes. I guess I was lucky. Mohan or Moan is a mythological figure that is prominent, especially in Colombian and Venezuelan popular culture and histories. The term was specifically used to refer to these actors by Spanish inquisitors. So, and specifically refers in the way in which is described in the record as a master of sorcerers. So it encompasses a certain kind of hierarchy, right? And it was very important for me to underscore how these historical actors, most of them slaves, many of them Africans, a lot of them also women, were not working the kind of in the periphery of the existence of knowledge production in the region or the marketplace of healing, that they were at the center. They were masters of their craft, and that they were, as I said before, crucial in the creation of ways of being in the world. And I think that is also crucial here, in at least in the way I conceive of the project, that they were not all only influencing isolated populations of African slaves or blacks in small towns outside of the big cities, Cartagena, Havana, or San Juan, but that they were at the center of how people thought the world, and specifically their bodies, worked. So this is a history that aims to recognize and to see them as the powerful figures that they were, right? Something that became possible to me because of the kind of records that came out of the Holy Office in Cartagena de Indias, the Inquisition, and the type of records that the type of evidence that these records convey. So it's more specifically about who they were, and I have in the book I have a table that compiles some of the many records that I was able to recover. I include in that table some of the most important actors, and certainly those for whom I was able to recover specifically practices of engagement with descriptions of the natural world and the body. But like them, there are other hundreds of these actors that inhabited the Caribbean throughout the 17th century.
So you begin the book with one of them, a man named Bernardo Macaya, and his voyage to Cartagena. Can you describe a little bit of who he was and why you began the book that way?
So Bernardo Macaya is a fascinating character, right? This is somebody who have been working in Portobelo, around Portobelo, in Panama, and who it was a renowned ritual practitioners operating around the region. It's important to recognize that when we talk here about these sort of practices, we're not only talking about healing practices, but practices that because of the way of the conception or the ideas, the ontology, the ideas about the world that these people had, and I'm not only talking about Africans, but also the Spaniards, Creoles, Native Americans, and all the other Europeans inhabiting the region, these claims had a political import, right? These practices were practices that made claims about control over not only the spiritual world, but the physical world. And it is that is the reason why they become object of prosecution by the Inquisition that we have to remember was a political arm also of the Spanish monarchy. As a matter of fact, the Inquisition in Cartagena de Indias was established initially to control Protestants and Jews coming into the New World. So these practices are practices that go beyond ideas about, alternative types of medicine or practices around nature that we can kind of seclude into cultural studies. No, these were practices that had very real consequences, very material consequences in that world of Cartagena. And that was exactly what happened with Bernardo, who was initially from West Central Africa and who became embroiled in basically the political regime of Portobelo in ways that make him a political target of the governor of Cartagena and the chief constable specifically in Portobelo in Panama. Bernardo, as many of the other practitioners that I described, had power over natural elements and it was only after a lot of negotiations that that he agreed to, for instance, as I mentioned in the book, to let the sea become calm enough for the ship to sail. At least these are the testimonies of the people living with Bernardo, the people who basically captured him and brought him to the city. But these were people that, as I said before, were extremely powerful, in ways that are hard to translate into our biomedicalized world in which these two spaces, the spaces of corporality and the natural world, are separated from that political realm. But these claims about how the world works and who is able to control it are very important. Another crucial part of the book, at least for me, is something that I become more and more interested in kind of underscoring.
Yeah. And so other scholars who study such people, there tends to be kind of two ways of looking at them, either that they are preserving and using a sort of African tradition that's being brought to the New World, or that they are sorcerers and witchcraft. They're using witchcraft to resist the system of slavery. And you seem to avoid both of those modes of interpretation and present something very new. Can you explain a bit about that?
Yes, this is something that I was it's at the center of the book, right? Like, I think that the ways in which we portray people like Bernardo Macaya or Paula de Guiluz or Antonio Congo is kind of follows, as you said, these trajectories that tend to locate them in these actors in interests that are, for my taste, mainly concerned with specific ideas about either products coming from Africa or ways of resisting, right, the hegemony of those colonial imperial spaces. And in those sort of views, the creativity the way the inventivity of these actors become lost, right? These are not people that were mainly interested in holding on to those mores that they brought with them, those who came from Africa, or in preserving them if they were born in the Caribbean. In this world that, as I said before, was not necessarily marred by the constraints of plantation and slavery, these Mohanes basically were involved mostly in process of imagining and creating strategies to deal with the world as it was. And I think part of the issue here is something that has been pointed out by many theorists in the Caribbean, like Trujillo, Glisson, that the notion that these are religious products, right, or cultural products is essential part of the historicism, right, in which we kind of tend to incorporate these histories. We also have to remember that it was in the 17th century, specifically, when that divide between culture and nature was born in Europe, right, by the projects of the natural philosophers and natural historians. And it is in that specific moment when these histories become object of cultural studies, right? That somehow these people are not dealing with the world as it is, but that they are dealing with interpretations about a world that is best described since the 17th century, supposedly through scientific practices. But if we actually take and inhabit the world that they are living, we realize that these are not practices that go and only become describable through that cultural realm, right? Like that these are practices that, as I said before, are very much involved in the shaping and the exploration, the classification of the world. It just happens that they do not conform very well with the epistemologies created, the kind of the systems of knowing the world that came out of Europe and that came to define the ways in which we ourselves do history and in which historical practices were developed. So it is in that space that these books enters also in trying to make an intervention.
Yes, and so you know the attention of the book is to how these men and women adapted their practices, took on new ones, learned about new environments and new populations. And the book is extremely rich in that regard, and we're certainly not going to be able to cover all of it. But can you describe to a small extent how they changed and how they learned and how they sought to ground their authority in this cosmopolitan world?
Absolutely. So one of the first things that became very apparent to me is that, as I said before, Cartagena and the Caribbean became the recipient of hundreds of thousands of African slaves. As a matter of fact, the Spanish Caribbean was the recipient of the vast majority of the slaves coming into the New World up to 1670. So we're talking about that deep Caribbean, that rooted history of communities of African descent in the New World. We have to look at this and how is that they did it, right? These were communities that did not have hundreds of people coming from, for instance, the Bight of Benin or of West Central Africa or of Benguela or Congo. They were cosmopolitan in their own way, right? And it was an African cosmopolitanism. Because of that, it was hard for ritual practitioners to kind of resort to the same sort of rituals or linguistic practices that would be recognizable for their clientele or for their communities, the communities that they were attempting to form in the Caribbean, and in that the experiential, the resort to what becomes tangible, what becomes becomes audible, what you can see visible, what you can smell, it was crucial, right? And as I said before, the clientele of these practitioners were not only people of African descent, but also Europeans and Native Americans. And in the book, I make reference to some of the most prominent examples, right? Because I think that they underscore the reach of their practices, like bishops, the Archbishop of the New Kingdom of Granada, the governor of Cuba, the lawyers, et cetera, but also Amerindian communities in encomiendas where they were summoned to heal Amerindians, right? And if you think about it, it was crucial for them to be able to experiment, to promote their own practices through something that spoke, or rather, that was that people coming from all these different spaces were able to feel, to sense, to experience, and that is why people like Mateo Arará experimented with plants in as he said before, in the term that he used to refer to Europeans, in Christians, right? Specific plants for Christians. People like Antonio Tongo also had gardens of botanicals also for that specific purpose. They experimented on themselves and in other patients. And indeed, this is another very interesting thing that happened. They came up with concepts about the universality of human bodies that most people tend to think were only developed or were starting to develop in Europe only by the end of the 17th century. But for these people of African descent, it was evident that the body had universal characteristics and different. That treatments that were effective in certain people from, let's say, European descent would also be equally effective in people from African descent. And they did so through their own practices. I hesitate to call them experimentation because this kind of invokes a certain kind of epistemological grounding that I don't think applies to the sort of world in which they actually develop these practices, but certainly something akin to that, and through also their own sensorial avenues, right? That is the other thing that is also crucial, that the world in which they were working does not only work, did not only kind of transpire through the senses that we understand in, right? The spiritual world was, they were able to smell the spiritual world, for instance, right? That sort of space also opens up different possibilities for how is that they also shape their own practices and the way people understood their practices, right? Making people sense the world differently, creating this sensorium in which that world will be able to be recognized.
In one of the chapters that you really describe how people feel and sense this sensorial landscape, as you call it, is the chapter on wonder and the role of wonder in how these Moanes assert their legitimacy and their authority in these communities. And you have here three stories, one of Antonio Congo, one of Domingo de la Ascension, and one of Cristobal Luango. Can you describe one of those three and a little bit about what we learn about their modes of working?
Absolutely. So Antonio Congo, for instance, was one of the most important practitioners in the second half of the 17th century in Cartagena de Indias. And Antonio was somebody who was very much attuned. This is a very good example of that idea of exploring that new world with their own tools. Somebody was attuned to the presence of Amerindian ancestors in the land, also using his own tools. And this is something that I have to emphasize. When I say that people of African descent were not uniquely interested in kind of preserving or this ideation of struggling to make sure that their own culture surviving in the world, I'm not saying that they were not using those tools that they or those ideas that they with which they grew up, right? Like the people like Antonio Congo were convinced, for instance, that the underground world was the world of ancestral entities. And he was very much worried and preoccupied about how to manage those spaces with those tools that he brought from West Central Africa. But for them to, for them and for Antonio specifically to demonstrate authority, he made use of very specific events. In the case of Antonio, one of my favorite stories in how he controlled, right, what he called un huracán, a hurricane, right? A word that we have to remember also is a word of Caribbean origin, right? A Taino word. And how in controlling that word, they cemented that authority, right, over that material space. And again, as I said before, and I want to reiterate this, it is in that space of control, classification, experimentation over the natural world that these historical actors become crucial part of how that understanding of nature, how the world actually works in the Caribbean becomes important. Domingo La Ascensión was famous in Cuba and traveled all around the central and southern, eastern part of the island. And Domingo was also somebody who made continuous use of these practices for good use, including transmutations, including the conversion of water into blood, and in many cases they were very much using what we will consider to be tricks, right? Like Vincent Domingo La Ascensión ostensibly said that he had been using attack to injure himself when he was transforming the transmutating the water into blood, and again, the reason, at least for me, the reason that this becomes so important for them is because it is in these moments when that experiential power becomes so important, right? These were not people who could claim authority based on kind of titles, old traditions, like for instance, the physicians were increasingly doing in Europe, right? These are not the physicians of the of biomedicine, where people trust their authority largely because medicine actually works, right? In very tangible ways, right? These physicians of the 17th century based their authority in that scholastic tradition of the university, in which it was titles and their management of certain kinds of philosophical claims allow them to be in control of at least the imagination of the body as it was. But for people like Domingo La Ascensión, the way in which they will gain authority was through that demonstration that they actually knew how to control the world in wondrous ways, right?
Thank you. Can you tell us a little bit about how you think the story relates to what we think of as the bigger narratives of the scientific revolution? Or does it affect how we see the meanings of wonder, experience, and empiricism in the new science in this era?
Absolutely. And again, this is something that I was about to mention too, right? Wonders, as we know very well from the narrative of the scientific revolution, become also very, very important, right, in the cementing of the epistemologies of natural philosophers. In the case of what the historical actors in the experiential Caribbean are doing, I believe that what we can see here is that these projects, right, these projects that are emerging in Europe about how to describe the world from experience tangibly, right, how to how to walk away, right, from the imposition of first principles, right, or dogma as a way of knowing the world was not exclusively an European project, right? That the circumstances of the Atlantic and the circumstances of the Caribbean in particular made that people like Africans and their descendants engage in similar projects within their own worlds, right? And this is not to say, this is important, right, that the history of these historical actors is similar or that it fits squarely within the histories of the scientific revolution. It's rather to say that there were, during the 17th century, multiple projects aimed at describing the world. And more importantly, right, this is something that is not important only for the 17th century, but afterwards, that if we're really interested in histories of knowledge production, we need to go beyond the limited epistemological spaces of the scientism and historicism, right? That the narratives that and the location of these historical actors, as you mentioned before, as others in histories of culture or religion, is not enough. If we are really interested in understanding how people understood the world materially, right? It's not how they think or how they imagine. This is how the world worked for them and how authority about managing nature was created. And again, that it was not only that innovation, creativity, experimentation, the idea of intellectual innovation did not only flow through European channels or through the histories of the scientific revolution, that these processes were happening everywhere. I mean, if we're interested, again, in the Caribbean, these are the actors that we have to look at. And I think we should be interested because it also locates very much in the old provincializing Europe idea, kind of that scientific revolution within a very specific context, right? All these tools function and work in very specific social contexts and political and economic, but also material contexts.
And so do you think that the work of these Moanes in their Malleu, did it have historical consequences? Does it change history?
Well, this is the precise point, right? Like, it depends on what history are you talking about, right? We're talking about that history that is marked in historicism, right? The narratives that incorporates them into a sort of a march that we can define and we can understand through European lenses. There are certainly ideas about how culture, societal practices, populating the region became shaped by these Moanes. Now, I don't think that is the most important way in which they shape those spaces. I think that the for me, one of the lessons here is that there is something that is lost, right? When we only look at them, you know, through the lenses of those historical processes in which we tend to think, again, through the lenses of historicism, right? That there is this vast history here that doesn't fit very well within the usual trajectories of empires, capitalism, the scientific revolution, Atlantic history in general, right? But that exists, that it's accessible, and that it actually, we're thinking about, again, how people felt the world in which they lived. We need to think differently about those trajectories, right? So certainly for me, even if those practices did not necessarily survive, and some of them actually did, it shows the importance of examining those creolized spaces, the spaces that do not seem to fit very well within those anachronistic categories of the indigenous, the African, the other, right, the slave, as they function in the construction of the narratives of the West, right? That there is something else here that we have been missing all along, and that is larger than the spaces in which we inscribe it in those histories that we tend to think when we think about history as historical practice, right? As it developed in the West.
And so their position and their moment in history is limited, it seems. Eventually the plantation system does begin to cement. What happens to them then, or the opportunity for their agency and their work?
But I don't think that they disappear, right? I think that those practices, those embodied practices, remain in the region, right? They remain in ways that are not recognizable as easily, and that's the point, right? Because they're not recognizable as easily with the tools that historicism provides us with, right? That the sort of ways of moving, these ways, the ways of sensing, understanding how that the world, the body, behaves. And this is what I said before. The thing, the crucial part of this history is that we have to remember that these communities never disappear, right? That the communities of African descent, they have places in Hispaniola, in the New Kingdom of Granada, for sure, where the plantation system never took root. In places like Cuba, those ideas about how the world works remain in place, right? They muted, they changed. Obviously, they did not remain static, precisely because the nature of the practices is the engaging is not an aim of survival. It's engaging with the world as it comes, as it is transformed, right? So it is because of that they seem to have disappeared, but they never did actually, right? Another example, if this is not one that figures in the book, but there are the ways in which we examine, for instance, the tool of these practitioners usually tend to be seen under the lenses of ethnographies that we have from 20th century anthropologists, right? The way in which we evaluate, for instance, ritual tools, which is very problematic, again, because if what the experiential Caribbean is proposing is true, and I believe it is, right, that these tools and these practices are located within something that is somehow ephemeral, right, that we can capture completely, they are necessarily adapting, right, to each one of those historical spaces that ensued after the 17th century. But as you see, is in that way of practicing, is in that way of sensing that remain for sure.
Wonderful, thank you. But I have one more question. But before I get to it, is there anything about your book that we've missed that you want to make sure is added here, or any specific character, any person that you want to make sure their story is?
Well, it is hard for me to know what people miss. One thing that I always underscore, and I think this is something that I try to emphasize in the book, it is the how it also changes how we think about gender dynamics in the region, right? And it is not only my work, but the work of several other scholars working in that early period. We see the presence of very powerful female figures, right? People like Paula de Guillouz. Unfortunately, the historical records is not as rich in the ways in which they are described in the Inquisition, for instance, in the Inquisition records. We do not have as rich descriptions as the ones that we have for people like Francisco Mandinga, again, Bernardo Macaya, Antonio Congo, Diego López, with few exceptions, and Paula de Guillouz being one of them. We can see, however, that it was women, for instance, the people who were at the center of these economies of healing and health in places like Karta and India. And this is obviously also from the number of denunciations that were brought up. And again, this is something that as I said before, kind of escapes the usual trajectories of historicism and the usual trajectories through which we see Black women, right, and their role in the Atlantic. So that is, something very important. These were also invested and involved in the very same kind of process that we usually tend to assign to white males, right, again in Europe. So, but thank you for the opportunity to say that, because I think that is also something that that I really attempted people to see.
Yeah. So my last question is about the sources. As I read this book, I'm continuously astounded by the amount of detail and information you are able to gather about these practitioners. Can you tell me a little bit about what the sources were like that you used for this and how they shaped the way this project came together?
Absolutely. I mean, as I said before, I was very lucky. This is a very rich trove of records that survive mostly in the Archivo Histórico Nacional in Madrid and in other spaces in the Archivo General de Indias. I use sources also coming from the Jesuit archives and the Vatican archives, but the Archivo General de la Nación, of course, in Colombia, and several other institutions around the United States and Europe. But the meat of, if you will, of the project comes from records coming from the Holy Office in Cartagena de Indias. And these records are exceptional in several ways. The first is that they were produced in Cartagena de Indias, right?
You mean the Inquisition?
The Inquisition, the Holy Office, yeah. They are special in a number of ways. First, we have to remember that there were only three Inquisition offices in the Spanish Americas. In the New World, as a matter of fact, in New Spain, in Mexico City, in Peru, in Lima, and the Inquisition in Cartagena. The Inquisition in Cartagena basically was in charge of processing all the denunciations coming from most of the Caribbean, and again the northern part of New Kingdom, Granada, Panama, Venezuela. It is the kind of records that we have and the information that I was able to translate comes mostly from those first audiences, those first encounters when these practitioners are by themselves in front of the Inquisition, and have not been yet put in contact or have kind of spent too much time in the inquisitorial realm. Why is that important? Because they are very candid about how they perceive the world, how they understand what is happening, why is that they were brought up to the Inquisition. And unlike, for instance, the history that comes from the Inquisition in Brazil, they were not somehow kind of shaped by the months that these practitioners spent in both the jail in Brazil and then later in transit to their trials in Portugal. And at the same time, they also speak to a certain kind of freedom, right, of practices, right? That many of them had no idea where they were brought because the practices were so commonplace in the region. And as a matter of fact, many of them worked for decades before they were brought up to the Inquisition. And in many cases, they did so on the basis of they appear on the basis of denunciations by physicians who brought them because they were their competitors, right? So these records transcribe as much as, you know, as we can understand or it was possible verbatim their declarations, right? They had the Inquisition in Cartagena had access to translators for about 70 African languages coming from the the Jesuit College in Cartagena de Indias. So many of them spoke through translators even after decades of being in Cartagena. Many of them did not speak Castilian. So that is another important thing for me, right? There is a mediation here, but I think that you will be hard-pressed to find records coming from the 17th century that actually have as close detail of what people of African descent, and especially Africans, were actually thinking. In this regard, Cartagena's records are, and I said this all the time, is they are more telling about what Africans and their conceptions of the world were than the usual missionary records that we have from the continent itself. I mean, from West and West Central Africa and, through Capuchin and Jesuit missionaries that are most of the information that we have. These are people speaking, out of their own volition in front of the Inquisition. Again, with all the issues that, and I understand the constraints of that inquisitorial realm. But those first audiences are very, very rich, precisely because of what I just said.
Well, fascinating. So I absolutely love this book, Pablo, and it deeply has influenced my own thinking about this era. What are you working on now?
Well, first, thank you. I'm glad that you enjoyed the book. I am right now working on a project of aims to trace the history of the quantification of corporality, quantification of human bodies to these Atlantic and Mediterranean spaces, slave spaces in the 16th and 17th centuries. So this is tracing back and it's also appending a little bit traditional histories of medical mathematics and even of political economy, right? Like I'm looking at how slave traders and slave trading communities all around the Atlantic came out first, even during the last decades of the 16th century and early decades of the 17th century, with ideas about fungible bodies, nosology, and treatments for universal bodies and ideas about risk that we usually only think emerged later in the 17th century and in the 18th century in terms of political economy, demographics in European spaces. So that is the project that I'm involved in right now. I'm hoping to finish a monograph within the next year or so.
Well, I can't wait to read it. Thank you again for your time, and good luck.
Thank you very much.